Welcome back to another episode of Palisade Radio. I'm your host, Karema Mutlu. And on today's show, we welcome Gregory Zuckerman, who is a financial writer for the Wall Street Journal and author of the best-selling books, The Greatest Trade Ever, and his most recent book, The Man Who Solved the Market. How are you today, Gregory?
I'm doing great. Great to be here.
You've been at the Wall Street Journal for over 20 years, so it'd be interesting to start to talk a bit about that and some of the financial stories you've covered within the markets, and perhaps a few of the highlights throughout your career so far, and give us a bit of background on yourself as well. How did you end up at the Wall Street Journal?
Sure. So I basically grew up fascinated by markets, interested in business, interested especially in investors, how people make a lot of money. I sort of stumbled into this career, though. I never really thought about writing about these people. I thought I'd go work on Wall Street, and it was a rough time. I didn't really have any opportunities. I didn't know anyone. I did well in school, but I hadn't really spent much time in markets and summers and such. And I'll shorten this story, but basically found myself with an opportunity to work for a financial publication. And I said, wait, hold on a second. I love writing. I love newspapers. And I also love markets and investing. And why not write about them too? So I put the two together, and it's been a career.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about your book, The Greatest Trade Ever, and how you got interested in writing about the housing bubble and the financial crisis. And one of the main characters that you followed was John Paulson. And what's fascinating to me is that for that trade, he was very early, he wasn't making any money on it, he got pressured to sell, and was actually laughed at for shorting the housing bubble back then. So talk to us about John Paulson, and do all the greatest traders go through this kind of experience to make outsized returns?
Yes. So basically, I had heard about how much money John Paulson had made and tried to figure out how he did it. And along the way, I stumbled into kind of a larger story, both about how the nation and the kind of the world got caught up in this credit crisis, but also how a group of outsiders figured out, anticipated, prepared for a meltdown that all the experts were shocked by. So if you think about who should have anticipated and been prepared for the financial meltdown, it should have been Bernanke and Geithner and Greenspan and the banks. The banks are the ones who created this toxic mortgage product that brought everybody down. And yet it wasn't those individuals or those firms, those banks. Instead, it was John Paulson, who's a merger investor, not a mortgage investor. So sort of the last person who should have made billions from the meltdown, and his colleague, Paolo Pellegrini, who really did a lot of the work behind the scenes to prepare for the trade and place the trade. He was a kind of washed up investment banker in his middle 40s, who really didn't have that much of a future. And then the others I write about, too, are just as unlikely. So that's sort of the paradox behind the whole book. It should not have been these investors who pulled it off. And I tell you the story about how they did. And it's not just Paulson, but it's a bunch of other interesting individuals. And that's sort of what I'm drawn to, that theme. Outsiders who get it right and the experts keep getting it wrong, because you see it time and time again.
Interesting. Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about today and the actions of the Fed and how this relates to gold. Are gold and other commodities set to take center stage over the next decade? I mean, it appears to me mainstream investors still appear very bullish on the general markets, even after such a long run-up, and that many of the successful traders from the housing crisis, like Michael Burry and John Paulson, have talked about gold in the past and why they've allocated some of their capital there. So what's your view on gold, Gregory, and how does the financial media represent it in your view?
So gold is an interesting investment because no one knows what it's worth. There's no cash flow, no earnings, no revenue. So it's impossible to say what gold is worth. It's sort of worth whatever you and I ascribe the value to. So it's not one that traditional investors embrace. It's difficult for them to put a valuation on it. But it's also one that historically has held up value. And we're talking, obviously, centuries and centuries. So as such, we keep coming back to it. And in times of crisis or turbulence, and we're in one of those periods right now, gold does well, and it's continued to do well over the past year or so.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your newest book, The Man Who Sold the Market. And to me, it's a great snapshot of what it takes to be successful as a trader and investor when looking at the markets, when using a brand new technology, in this case, mathematical data. But how, even after a decade, Jim Simons didn't really do much in terms of the fund's performance. But then when everything came together, it all turned around. So can you talk a bit about the book and what investors can learn from an investor like Jim Simons?
Yes, that's one of the surprising elements of my book, The Man Who Sold the Market. Jim Simons and his firm, his fund, Medallion Fund, is the key fund. They're up 66% a year since 1988. They really are the greatest money-making machine Wall Street has ever seen, the financial industry has ever seen, and they continue to do so well. And they're pioneers. They pioneered algorithmic trading, rules-based, systematic trading, everything that people are trying to do today. And 31% of all trading today is by quants, by quantitative investors. And back when he was doing it, no one was doing it. He was a pioneer. So he is going to go down in history as the greatest moneymaker the financial industry has ever seen. But the paradox here, the surprising element is it should not have been Jim Simons and his colleagues, because they are scientists, they're mathematicians. They don't really care too much about investing in trading per se. Simons always had an interest in trading, but his colleagues didn't. They don't even invest for themselves. Sometimes their spouses are the ones who do their investing for the family. So it shouldn't have been these individuals. And maybe there's a lesson there. Sometimes it takes outsiders to succeed.
And when we talk about algorithms, can the average retail guy still make money within the markets? There is one interesting part of the book where, even though Jim made all this money from algorithms and the data and the models, he still wanted to intervene because he was worried that there was a crash around the corner from his point of view, but not the algorithms. So talk to us about that a little bit.
Yeah, so that's another one of the surprising elements. Jim Simons is the premier quant, and yet even he was tempted to adjust the models. Now, he didn't usually do it. He almost always lets the models run on their own. But there are times when even quants panic. And I write about them in the book, and there are lessons there as well. And as you suggested earlier, one of the shocking elements I found was that Simons, it took him over a decade to figure this thing out. And there were twists and turns along the way. He tried being a traditional investor, more of a macro kind of investor, and that didn't work out and left him sick to his stomach. On days he made money, he felt like a hero. On days he lost money, he felt like a dope is the way he described it. But he literally had physical pains in his stomach, and he just couldn't trade in a traditional way. And instead, he shifted to developing models, pre-existing algorithms, telling him what to buy and sell so he didn't have to use his own intuition and judgment. And today, that's again how the best trading is done more often than not. Now, the question, as you say, is, well, what does the individual investor do? And I think there is still opportunity for the individual investor, but you can't be going up against Jim Simons and Renaissance Technologies, as you read in the book. They're just too powerful and too advanced when it comes to data, collecting data, analyzing data, and such. So you've got to be a much more longer-term investor than in the past, because Simons and his colleagues don't do long-term investing. They, generally speaking, on average, hold their positions about 2 days. So they're not high frequency, but they're also not long-term trading by any stretch of the imagination. So to me, that's what the average investor needs to do. Find a niche that they have some competitive advantage in and trade longer term than guys like Simons.
And perhaps what's the biggest lesson you've learned from all the research you've done on these successful traders from your books?
Yeah, I think one of the lessons is that outsiders sometimes have an advantage, not always, but you want to take what the experts say with a grain of salt. You got to be a little bit skeptical, because time and time again, the experts keep getting it wrong. You look at the 2008 meltdown, like we said earlier, you look at the energy revolution. To me, that's the biggest business story of the last decade or so, how the United States went from a country desperate and unable to find oil and gas to one that's actually exporting oil and gas. And I wrote a book about that as well because of the same theme that the experts got it wrong. All the major oil and gas companies, BP, Exxon, Mobil, all the big ones had given up on America. And it took some unlikely, odd individuals to lead the revolution. So, and you can look in the world of politics too. You know, the experts keep getting the elections wrong. No one anticipated Brexit. No one anticipated the 2016 Trump election. So one of the lessons is not to ignore the experts, but to be a little skeptical and to have an eye out for the oddball outsiders. Those are the people that I write about. And sometimes they know what they're talking about. And just to kind of not necessarily always subscribe to their views, but to listen to them, listen to the outsider perspective. And there's also, I think there are other lessons, especially from my book, The Man Who Solved the Market. And it's to be careful about relying on judgment and intuition. And either as an investor or even as a politician, we've got people who lead the country, lead the world, who generally speaking are proud of relying on intuition and judgment and gut instinct. And one of the lessons that I've learned from The Man Who Solved the Market is just how that we sometimes, we as investors and just as humans, we embrace stories. And stories, we think we're really good judges of character, be it executives, CEOs, et cetera, others. But sometimes embracing stories leads to real problems, real losses. You look at things like WeWork and Theranos and Uber. You know, investors, even sophisticated investors, got carried away with the story and the narrative. And I'm not saying you don't need to keep an eye out for narrative and to sometimes keep it in mind, but systems are more powerful than stories, meaning developing some sort of rules-based system to govern anything. I mean, if you're a pilot, there are checklists you go through. You got to stick with those checklists. There are rules. Surgeons as well, and investors need to do that as well, as opposed to kind of winging it. And it's just become much more hard, much harder for any kind of fundamental type investor than ever before.
Okay, let's wrap it up today, Gregory. Many thanks for your time, and hopefully we'll have you back on the show later in the year.
Sounds great. Have a good day.
Think you understand the junior mining sector and you think that the participants in the mining sector, junior mining sector, are good people and kind people, hit the bid.
How violent that term could be, it actually could be quite violent. It could be a rip your face off uranium rally.
And the world is always going to need raw material. It's going to need copper and gold and nickel and so forth.
Totally destabilized. Hey, troll, did you hear what's going on in Yemen?